The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're @NewstalkScience, and we get to all of those later on in the podcast from last week. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be speaking to an Irish researcher who appears to have found a biomarker that will help predict which people are likely to develop severe psychotic disorders before they even have them. Before that, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me via Skype are Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from Science Foundation Ireland, Dr. Ruth Freeman. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Shane. It's all kicking off in the ISS. Last week we had a near miss and they had to hide off in the Russian wing. And now there's more trouble in Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we spoke about this avoidance maneuver last week that the International Space Station had to execute with all three of the astronauts barreling into the Soyuz capsule in case things went wrong. Well, things have continued to be rather interesting up there. Late on Monday night, there was more drama on the space station. It sprung a leak, which is terrifying when you think of the fact that they're out in the vacuum of space. On the Russian side of the International Space Station, for conspiracy theorists listening, and the three astronauts again had to literally batten down the hatches and get into the escape capsule for fear that this leak might turn dangerous.
Out of oxygen within the ISS, right? Not a leak in.
Absolutely. So down here, like when I was a PhD student, I always felt so sorry for people who had to work with vacuum technology because it is so hard to actually maintain a vacuum. When you're in the International Space Station, it's the opposite. It's incredibly hard to maintain an atmosphere in there with gases that the astronauts can breathe. And a tiny hole is going to suck out all of the gases into the vacuum of space very, very quickly. And so these things are dangerous. NASA have said that they've known about this leak for quite a while. And so I suspect that the hole just got larger and that the rate of escape
should do something about that. It's kind of funny that you say that, Shane, because when we think about holes in things in space, in movies, they're very dramatic. So this wasn't as dramatic as it sounds.
No, unfortunately, like Sandra Bullock was not involved in this one, so it didn't have that level of drama. But they have to find these holes. And so what NASA have said, I think, is brilliant optimism that they're no longer longer looking for multiple holes, that they originally suspected this may have had, you know, multiple holes, like a pincushion. And now they've narrowed it down to one, and they're still searching for it. I guess this hole doesn't have to be that large for it to allow gas to seep out, but it's the rate at which it happens.
It's a messy place, the International Space Station.
It sure is.
Imagine losing your wallet there. Like, you'd be looking forever. There's stuff everywhere.
There is, because it's built by so many space nations in the world, including the European Space Agency. There's bits that have been put together. It is a triumph of international relationships. So they're going to send up more air, which is good. In the next couple of weeks, three new astronauts will go up, interestingly, on a SpaceX rocket and not a Russian rocket. And they have, for the year that's in it, they've named the rocket Resilience.
It's like a whole new meaning to those weekend jobs. It's like send air, find the leak, you know, all of those things that are on your list to do.
Ruth, you have two good news stories, because often we give you the climate change ones, which are never, never good. And I can see you over the Skype link, so your face sort of creases when you give us the bad news. This is good news. This is good news. So the first one is new developments on plastic eating enzymes. We've covered this science a couple of times on the program because I'm particularly invested in the idea of solving that problem. What's going on here?
Yeah, you're right. We've talked about plastics quite a lot on the programme. And as we know, the whole idea of recycling plastic, as we feel good filling up our green bin, that's a bit of a myth. And in fact, most of the plastic that we're putting into the waste stream is not getting recycled. So since, you know, the beginning of plastic production, where we've produced over 8 billion tons of plastic, only about 9% of that has ever been recycled. So researchers are always looking at ways to see, well, how could we make that stream of what is this really, really important material more sustainable? And back in 2016, researchers in Japan found a bacteria, a naturally occurring bacteria, in one of their waste processing plants that was able to biodegrade, to eat up plastic, PET plastic that we see in plastic bottles. And scientists in the UK and the States took that enzyme and they looked at different variants of it. And what they found was that they were able to produce a version that ate plastic a little bit quicker and still at room temperature, which was really exciting because a lot of enzymes need heat. So enzymes are sort of special chemicals that make chemical reactions happen, but they often need heat and energy, whereas this one happens at room temperature. Now, they found another enzyme in a bacteria in Japan. And in this paper, they've actually combined these two enzymes together. So the one that was already working better, about 20% better, has been combined with this other new enzyme to make this enormous protein that a bacteria could never make naturally, but it can break down plastic 6 times faster than the original bacteria. So it's sort of getting to a point now where you could see this as an industrially relevant application, because so often we talk about stories here and they work in the lab where they're very expensive and you couldn't see them scaling up. But this is this technology definitely looks like it has potential. And the researchers are talking about having it at industrial scale in 2 years, which,
wow,
in terms of technology transfer from kind of academic research, that's really, really fast.
What sort of output, like what sort of waste do you get when you do this? Like, do you end up creating waste of a different kind, or do you have useful products or useful raw materials again?
So what's exciting about this is you're actually breaking the plastic back down to sort of the virgin components. And again, that's historically been a big problem with plastic recycling, that you're sort of getting biodegraded small bits of plastic. You may even be creating more microplastics in the process. So often when we talk about plastic bottles being turned into fleece or polyester, you know, that's been melted down and then spun into long threads and then put into fabrics. But, you know, in that process, you're using chemicals, you're using bleaching agents and you're releasing microplastic.
Yeah.
Here, this is acting as food for the bacteria and they're able to break things down into the component parts. So you could essentially be starting with perfect raw materials each time. And that's what's really game changing potentially about this technology.
Yeah, it's not particularly exciting to talk about the circular economy, but when it comes to plastics, finding a way to close that loop would be just amazing.
I think researchers are sometimes reluctant to talk about it because the big thing is still reduction in our usage of plastic.
That's
and
true.
You know, none of these technologies are going to mean that we continue to live the way that we do. I mean, a lot of our clothing now is dependent on petroleum. I mean, think about all of those polyester mixes, they're coming from oil. So we need to start seeing the plastic in our lives and thinking about reducing it across the board. But technologies like this will really help.
Shane, in an exciting discovery on Mars, there are underground lakes.
Yeah, this is an extremely exciting paper in Nature Astronomy from some Italian colleagues. They've discovered 3 large underground lakes near the Martian South Pole. So this was first hinted in 2018. I think we spoke about it on this program. Mm. And in the meantime, scientists did what they do best, which is they went back and got more data. And they have used a radar technology that's used on Earth to look at underground lakes to do a sort of flybys of the Martian South Pole, collecting a lot more data and looking at rather expansive underground lakes of water. But kind of the trick is here, it's not really water, it's sort of water, it's very, very, very salty water. This is the interesting part, right? This is the next chapter, is in what could be in that salty water. Could there be life in there?
Which I suppose we're very obsessed with this topic, aren't we? Which whenever I interview, astrobiologists or astronomers, they kind of go, yeah, there is there life outside Mars question. But it's just one of those things that constantly fascinates us. Is there anything interesting from a geology point of view, Shane?
Well, yes, I suppose the fact that Mars being such a cold place, the fact that there could be liquid water underground is very interesting. And so they suspect that there must be an incredible amount of dissolved salt in that water, and that's how it is in liquid form. So that's how they're guessing that there's salt in the water. The fact that it's in liquid
it shouldn't make any sense that they have liquid water, because it should be frozen, but very salty water has a different freezing point.
Yeah, and on Earth there are living things in very salty conditions. So there are things called halophiles, which is a type of bug, and it lives in very salty conditions. So they're saying, you know, of similar salt concentrations on Earth, you can find living things. The difference with Earth and Mars here is the temperature. So could something be alive on Mars in a salty and cold environment? And whilst it is a recurring idea, this, you know, astrobiology obsession, it is very important, because if we can show that life took hold somewhere outside of the biosphere on the Earth, it shows that it could happen more regularly than in other rocky planets, and that we should go looking more carefully within our own solar system and beyond it for signs of life.
Ruth, our final story has to do with a paper that documents a type of skin regeneration that is really promising.
I know, hope for all of us that are watching wrinkles form on Zoom calls every day. this is research from Washington State University, and it builds on knowledge, I suppose, that scientists have had for many decades. And that is that if you do surgery in utero, that there's no scar from that surgery. So what we understand is when skin is still forming at that very early stage, even if it's damaged, it can repair itself without a scar. And of course, we know when we get a scar anywhere on our body, one of the characteristics of that scar is that there usually are no hair follicles left on it. So it won't get goosebumps, for example, if you get very cold, because there's no hair follicles in the scar tissue. So the team in Washington State University decided to look at the factors that get turned on when hair follicles are being formed in that early development stage. And they used a really exciting new technology looking at single cells and all of the genes and proteins that are turned on in a single cell. Because although we've known that this early skin doesn't scar, skin is such a complex mix of different cells and tissue types that it's been very hard to pick out exactly what might be going on at those very early stages. So using this single cell analysis, they were able to find a factor that's turned on when the hair follicle has been formed. And they could see that this little switch gets turned off once the skin has formed, and it never turns on again in adulthood.
Nice.
Yeah, so they were then able to look, using a mouse model, at adult skin. And when they applied this factor to adult skin, they were able to see that it was able to heal without forming scar tissue. And the healed skin had hair follicles, and it could form goosebumps, and it had all of those characteristics of newborn skin.
Is it possible that this could be an injection or a cream?
I think it's too early to say at this point. Yeah, I think it's too early to say. But certainly, I think the innovation here is that they're able to look at the individual elements of skin, which is a complex organ. So we often talk about analyzing organs, or, you know, and it's the same with even a tumor analysis. You're not looking at something that's completely homogenous and is the same throughout.
Yeah.
Different things are going on at different times in living tissue. So to be able to get down to that level of these fibroblast cells, which are in the layer of skin sort of underneath the top, which are really important in early development, to find the factor. And again, I think it was clever that they were looking at hair follicle formation, and to be able to turn that back on again is a really exciting advance when we look at skin. And I think it's interesting because it's something we've known for ages, but we haven't been able to find out why. Yeah. And so it's nice to see that.
Very cool. Well, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, thank you very much. Coming up, could we one day have a blood test to predict schizophrenia? Now, in recent years, the stigma surrounding mental illness has thankfully been at least partially eroded. And while we might be on more understanding of someone's particular situation, there are still many obstacles to overcome. But what if we were able to accurately predict which people may be more likely to develop psychotic symptoms? What could we do then? Well, Professor David Cotter, Professor of Molecular Psychiatry at RCSI, joins us now. Welcome to the programme, David.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on.
Let's perhaps do a bit of definition stuff, if you don't mind. When we talk about psychotic disorders and psychotic episodes, what do we mean exactly?
Okay. So you mentioned psychotic symptoms there. And psychotic symptoms aren't so bad. In fact, they're quite common in children and young people. Up to 20% of the population, if you believe it, actually hear voices when they're very young. So psychotic symptoms can be normal in the young. It's when you reach psychotic disorder that you get worried. And that's a disorder where you have a persistent psychotic experiences, such as maybe having auditory hallucinations, more rarely visual hallucinations, and maybe paranoid ideas or delusions that cause distress to you and may get cause you to have a decrease in functioning. So that's a psychotic disorder, probably one of the most expensive, distressing disorders of mental illness that you can have, and amongst the most expensive that the population can have. The reason being that they affect people young and the outcome isn't always so good. And people don't always get full employment or have normal occupation or social interactions. So that's why psychotic illnesses are so important. What's interesting is that people tried maybe 15, 20 years ago, people called Pat McGorry, Alison Young from Australia, they tried to work on the idea of prevention, just like we tried to prevent all medical illnesses, with the idea that if you treat people and identify them early, they do better. So the same concept was relevant for psychotic disorders. So they developed what's called the clinical high risk paradigm. So it was, they identified that people who had these sort of fleeting psychotic experiences, who may have a family history of a psychotic illness, and who had paranoid ideas, that they didn't quite reach criteria for being a disorder, but things weren't right. And they identified that among this group, about 30 to 40% would go on to develop a psychotic illness. So right, they were able to enrich from the general population, a particular group amongst whom there was a reasonable percentage, 20 to 30%, who would go on to psychotic disorder.
I think it's important at this point because people unfortunately associate the word psychotic with necessarily violent episodes and sometimes violent individuals because of portrayals in popular culture. But psychotic episodes aren't usually violent, and people who have psychotic disorders are rarely violent to others and to themselves. Is that right?
Yeah, violence occurs. Violence occurs in the general population, just as it does among people who have mental illness. Mm. There can be violence there, but I mean, the biggest damage to people who have psychosis is really clearly to themselves, to their lives, and to the lives of the people who care for them and look after them. So violence really, while it's worth noting, and we need to have resources in the community to look after these people. Do you know that the percentage of the budget in Ireland that goes to mental illness is 6%? Do you know what it is in the United Kingdom? It's up to 13 to 15%. That is a gobsmackingly significant difference. We get half the amount of funding for mental illness in Ireland, with the result that the resources to people in the community who are psychotic or unwell is really limited. So that's a big problem, actually.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae, and I'm speaking with Professor David Cotter from the RCSI about a new biomarker that could predict those likely to develop a psychotic disorder. How do you go about doing that? Is it a genetic route you take, or are there other ways of doing it?
No, it's interesting. There are about 1,000 genes responsible for schizophrenia. So genetics, I don't think, are going to help us. What we did is we looked at the bloods of children, young people who are in what's called the clinical high risk. As I described what that is earlier on, is people with fleeting psychotic experiences, paranoid ideas, fleeting, but not disorder. And so when they first presented with these symptoms, we took their bloods, we being a term for a lot of people across the world who are working with us. Mm. And they were followed up for 2 years, and those who became psychotic were noted, and those who got well were noted. And we compared the bloods when they first presented amongst those who did and did not become a psychotic illness. And we basically found some proteins which were really, really amazingly good at discriminating those who become psychotic disorder later on. It was really surprising to us. It was amazing, actually. People have been doing neuroimaging studies and psychology studies and all sorts of EEG studies over the years, and nothing is discriminated as well as this. So we obviously have to replicate it, but we were gobsmacked. And the population was several hundred. So we took one of the samples out that we had used in the analysis, and we used the other samples and created a mathematical analysis, an algorithm. And we applied that algorithm to the samples from London, and we'll still be able to predict those who'd become psychotic and not. So it looks very convincing.
Just to be clear for the audience, yeah, you're saying you've identified a biomarker that can help sort out those who are likely to go on to have psychotic disorders from those who are not.
Amongst the people who have clinical high risk. That's the critical bit. It does need to be confirmed, obviously, but yes, no, we have done that. And there's Wellcome Trust funded us to try to confirm that in some other studies across the world.
David, one of the things that this really hammers home to me is the biological nature of mental health and mental illness.
Yeah, no, the there is a biological marker here. And what the proteins mean, actually, is probably that there's an inflammation going on amongst those who will later develop psychotic disorder. It's probably a chronic inflammation. And what the cause of that is, we don't really know. It could be due to adversity, stress of some form, or vulnerability to adversity in these people. We don't really know the bottom line is what's causing it, but we see these markers. And I suppose there's a few implications that you'd want to take from this. One is that these proteins potentially could be targeted by drugs in the future, which will try to normalize those abnormal pathways to make things normal again. Secondly, that it could be used obviously as prediction, and that's what we're trying to do. But to predict, it means you need to have a change in the clinical services, such that your GPs and your child psychiatrists will actually have more time to identify children and young people who are in the clinical high risk. So at the moment, we don't really go out looking for people in the clinical high risk. So this biomarker wouldn't be useful until we have good services which are able to identify these people and then to apply the test to them. So services could actually change in quite a fundamental way if this biomarker is confirmed to be real.
What's known about this protein otherwise? Has it been discovered as a factor for anything else? Is it known to be produced for any other reason?
So actually this protein, there are several proteins involved. Actually, it's sort of a pathway of one protein interacting with the next and so on. And so that's why it's quite neat. It's nice when the proteins you show to be abnormal sort of interact with each other in a meaningful way that makes sense. So another reason we think it's real. What are they involved in? They're actually involved in inflammation. They're probably markers of inflammation. Which is really stress causes inflammation. But it could be that these people have a genetic vulnerability to not coping with inflammation as well. So it could be that there could be some drugs that will be able to be developed in the future, which could act on them. But I think the most important thing would be if you identified people who are at risk of developing psychotic disorder, you could then give psychological treatments to them. You could focus good diets on them, omega-3 fatty acids, good diets, less stressful family supports, all these things. In a difficult home environment with a lot of stress, these people would be more vulnerable, and you could target them and give them more resources.
Obviously, these proteins come from genes, and we share a lot of genes with animals, which is why we use animal models in labs. I'm just wondering, is there an analog for schizophrenia in mice and or rats? And is it possible then to explore the use of this protein, maybe turning it on or off these genes and seeing whether or not we could modulate that, the likelihood of having that psychotic disorder?
No, that's a really good question. I think there is. Well, so the first thing is, it's very difficult to have a model of schizophrenia, because schizophrenia is a symptom really where you're talking about the internal experience of auditory hallucinations, paranoid ideas. You'll never know what a mouse or a rat is thinking. But there are some models which share some of the biological characteristics of schizophrenia, which I think are probably useful. And one of the best I think, is a model of where mothers of rats are exposed to stress in utero, and the offspring. It very much reflects the experience of some people with schizophrenia and the epidemiological risk factors of prenatal stress and adversity in adolescence. Right. So there is animal models where they have these various stresses. And I think it would be very useful to see if these proteins were altered in association with these adversities in animals, and then whether drugs which would affect these proteins were useful in normalizing the behavior of the mice, for example. So the proteins that we found to be abnormal are involved in complement proteins, which you think about normally as being involved, complement and coagulation, normally involved in blood. But in fact, they've got important roles in the brain, in the synapse, and in inflammation. So one of the ideas for psychosis is that there is an abnormal inflammation, chronic inflammation, which somehow affects the body generally, and can have effects on people's metabolism, so high BMI and things like that, but also affect the brain so that the synapse is affected in the neurons, and these are sort of abnormally eaten up a little bit. So the synapses don't have, it's like a tree in the winter versus a tree in the summer. There aren't as many synapses. So people think that complement may be involved in this. And indeed, one of the strongest genes for schizophrenia, which is definitely associated with the disease, is one of the complement proteins. And in fact, what they're one of the proteins that we found to be abnormal in the blood. So animal models, I think, might have a role. And drugs which modify the proteins that we've shown to be abnormal could be tested in animal models to see if they're protected.
I remember speaking to Professor Brendan Kelly on this program. He's a psychiatrist at Trinity College, and he was talking to us when we were discussing lobotomy on the program, and we were investigating lobotomies that happened in Ireland. And I said, if we look back at what happened to those people now with a great deal of regret and a great deal of shame, what is the lobotomy of our generation? And he said, you know, it is how we both view and treat people with severe mental illness. And it really stuck with me as a point. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, bearing in mind that even though you've identified this biomarker, there are a huge amount of things that have to change in how we provide services for people who suffer from psychotic disorders in the first place.
No, there's a case in the London, in England, about 10, 15 years ago, Jonathan Zito, a gentleman who was very psychotic, and as a result of that, an innocent person was killed. He himself was innocent. And as a result of that, there was a huge change in the amount of funding that went into mental health services in the UK, because they realized this man had not been treated, and it was just a disaster for the families and the people, and everyone realized this. This happens in Ireland quite often. Unfortunately, there are tragedies, but there hasn't led to any change in the amount of funding to mental health services. So our amount of funding is half it is in the UK, and people with mental illness are not well served. We closed down the mental hospitals, the large institutions. The funding was supposed to go in to provide state-of-the-art services in the community, and they simply don't exist. So there's a shoestring amount of funding, 50% that probably should be there, is available to people. So people with mental illness do not get well served. That there aren't the psychologists, the social workers, the dietitians available to these people that there should be. And there's a huge increase in the mortality. People with major psychotic illnesses can die 20 years earlier, not from suicide, but from diet, from metabolic syndrome, from high BMI, smoking, cigarette, malnutrition. It is a tragedy. It's happening in front of us, and we seem to find it acceptable. And I really wish journalism would jump onto this and to push this case, because we don't have the services for the mentally ill in Ireland, and we don't seem to be pushing forward and advocating it as much as we should be. It is something that we really need to look back on with shame, I think.
I think the figure you gave, in case people are wondering, it's not half of what the UK are spending. It's half as a percentage of overall spend. And I think you're absolutely right. I think it's just one of those things that we don't like to talk about and don't like to think about. And unless it directly affects you, it pops up around election time very rarely. And that's about it. It's a tragic waste of often a young person's entire life and decimates the family and friends around them. Professor David Cotter from RCSI, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Now to get to some of your texts and tweets from last week's programme, we were talking about personalised vaccines. Peter says, sorry, Jonathan, this guy lost me with his mask fanaticism. There's a couple of messages like that where people want to question whether or not we should wear masks, and another person saying, you know, vaccines are no use and we should be interviewing someone else for balance. The great thing is I don't have to do that. Nor do I have to respond to... mask deniers. Are they mask deniers? Do we have a term for them? I've had wear a mask in my bio for quite some time, so it's pretty obvious how I feel about that. I'm not going to go down that road again. We were talking about the kindness of strangers with Michael McCullough, and he was trying to understand why people are altruistic and so on. And I asked him, you know, learning from some of these psychology experiments in labs, could we, you know, influence people to be better? And someone texted in a good response to that. They said, what constitutes good or being good is subjective. So manipulating people to do good is just as dodgy as to get them to do bad. Encourage critical thinking instead. Yeah, but what if they're bad and they have critical thinking? No, I'm joking. This is a very good point that, you know, any good act can be misinterpreted as a bad act. One of my favorite things to do with my kids is to retell fairy tales from the point of view of the so-called bad guy. And it's a fun exercise, but it also shows that you need to evaluate all the information and also question the source of the story. We also had a really interesting piece in the news about butterflies and how they regulate temperature and how climate change is affecting that, and about how they need more shade. And it felt like, to me, butterflies are so small, the landscape is pretty big, shade shouldn't be that hard to find. But Vera says, I'm a nature lover and I don't mow my lawn. One day I used a trimmer to tidy up, and when I started to cut a big clump of grass, two large moths flew out. I stopped the trimmer and the moths flew back into the high grass. I know you were skeptical that butterflies need shades, but I've seen them also in very high grass. Love your program. That's true. Like, I suppose they do. They do love the long grass. So I don't know. I just felt like we feel bad about so many things. Like, finding shade for butterflies just seems like I guess my empathy tank was empty that day. And then we had another story from news, which was a rather unusual one. A scientist read a story about a knife that was made from frozen poo, and wanted to know if this was actually based in a real fact, or was it just a myth? And so he froze his own feces and showed that it makes a terrible knife. Freddie has emailed in saying, hi, science people. I was chopping some mushrooms while listening to the podcast, and the concept of frozen feces knives was mentioned, which then made me think of me chopping my mushrooms and onions with it. To be fair, it'd probably do a better job than my current blunt knife, but still a rather unsettling thought to have doing what I was doing. Yes, I'm sorry about that, Freddie. I was aware that for some people, with the number of people that listen to the show, some people may be adversely affected. So apologies for that, but you know, it's in the past. Let's just move on, shall we? That's it from us for this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McCalvey, who was producing, Simon Keane, Garrett Mulhall, and Stephen Daunt were researching. On sound with Stephen McLean. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed on Tuesday. Just find it wherever you found this. In the meantime, stay curious.